Well, you know it's hunting season when Arby's begins offering venison sandwiches. Michigan is one of six states, according to MLive, where Arby's will begin testing venison sandwiches. And that should have already happened at several locations. Clio, Cedar Springs, Plainwell, and Birch Run, Michigan. We're a brand that's not afraid to take risks, says Arby's Rob Lynch, Chief Marketing Officer and Brand President of Arby's Restaurant Group, Inc. The venison sandwich features a thick-cut venison steak, onions, with a berry sauce on a toasted roll, according to the company. It's the last day of the month, and October's Month in Review segment. We're offering a Michigan election update. Next Tuesday, voters determine 16 Michigan congressmen and women, all 110 members of the State House of Representatives and many other offices, here to review the landscape and bring us up to speed. Chad Livengood, State Capitol reporter for the Detroit News. Hi, Chad.
Good morning.
And Susan Demas, publisher and editor of Inside Michigan Politics. Hi again, Susan.
Hi, Mark.
We could spend all the time we have on the presidential election, James Comey, and so on and so on. We do want to focus on Michigan. But that said, let's take a moment or two and hear your thoughts on how this extended FBI investigation into more Hillary Clinton emails, along with the narrowing lead for Hillary Clinton in the polls, how this might impact Michigan. Susan, what thoughts are top of mind for you today?
Well, obviously the big news is that Donald Trump is coming back to Michigan with just about a week to go before Election Day. That's certainly exciting Republicans who are hoping that there's some last-ditch effort to finally flip Michigan, which has not happened since 1988.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan is one of three states that Trump will be concentrating on. He's also looking at New Mexico and Wisconsin, two other blue seats. Minnesota seems to be on the list as well, maybe a little further down. But, you know, so far it's a little early to say if there's an impact in the polls with the Comey news. I think if you look at the tightening, it's more Republicans coming home to Trump, so
yeah,
it could dampen Democratic enthusiasm.
We have seen a number of U.S. representatives who previously came out against Trump, kind of a never-Trump kind of position, and a number of them are now on board. What thoughts are top of mind for you, Chad?
Well, as far as the dampening of enthusiasm, yesterday Tim Kaine, the Democratic vice presidential candidate, was in Taylor and Warren. And in Taylor, he talked about how he says this has actually revved Democrats up. I mean, you saw over the weekend multiple congressional Democrats coming out and denouncing this late letter from the FBI director, calling on him to come out with more information. I think there's going to be some more pressure today to do that, and so they're trying to turn the script if they can. But Republicans really are enthused about this. This is really what they needed after weeks. I mean, most of the fall, Donald Trump has played defense. He's effectively playing offense, and he's coming to Michigan today, and he's going to Wisconsin tomorrow, and I'm told that he's going to be giving another big address, maybe in Pennsylvania and in the Philly suburbs tomorrow. So he's trying to make an attempt to change the trajectory of this race that has been a roller coaster, to say the least.
And four stops for Cher in stumping for Hillary Clinton, one of them here in East Lansing this afternoon. I'll ask one more related question here, and that is, what's your take on how many undecided voters there are out there right now? There's a school of thought that says none of this makes any difference. People's minds were made up a long time ago, but it doesn't answer the question, how many undecideds are out there that might be swayed one way or the other? Is there a significant undecided percentage in Michigan as far as you see it, Susan?
I don't think it's particularly high. Generally, undecideds break fairly evenly in races, but, you know, that's the hope of the Trump campaign. They really need the undecideds to break towards them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's in the single digits. It's going to be a matter of getting them interested in coming out and voting now. I mean, if they were basically pretty, you know, undecided because they just were so turned off by this campaign. That's going to be the key point here. And the other thing is, I checked with the clerk's office today, or the Secretary of State's office. You can actually change your absentee ballot. If you've already voted, you can go back to your clerk and ask for a new one. And it's a little bit of a process, but it's interesting. The Republicans are now pushing that because there's, you know, one in four voters is effectively are going to be voting absentee. There's already a million absentee ballots out there. Mm. And that's another big thing this week you're going to see. If you have an absentee ballot, you're going to be getting a phone call or a knock on your door from someone from the Republican or Democratic Party.
Let's narrow our focus here and talk about the two congressional races of greatest interest to our listeners, the 8th and the 7th. Both are, what, dependably Republican districts, at least in recent history. First, the 8th. Share your impressions of where this contest is between incumbent Mike Bishop, Democratic challenger Susanna Shkreli. A week out, Susan?
We should say there are 14 seats on the ballot because neither of the two Senate slots are up, so it's not 16. As far as the 8th goes, that one was pretty well off the radar after Melissa Gilbert, the Democratic nominee, dropped out. She's the actress that everybody knew and had run a pretty lackluster campaign. But the Democrats nominated a young Macomb County assistant prosecutor, Susanna Shkreli, and I think she has kind of taken Bishop off guard a bit, running an aggressive campaign, doing some decent fundraising, going up on air. But really, short of a gigantic Democratic wave, this one should really stay in Republican hands.
What have we heard recently from these campaigns, Chad?
Well, I mean, you definitely saw after in late September, early October, suddenly Mike Bishop was coming out on the attack against this little-known opponent who has never had an elective office, and Mike Bishop obviously used to be the state Senate majority leader and has been in Michigan politics for many years. So this was obviously supposed to be sort of in the bag after Melissa Gilbert crashed and burned back in May, and they thought it was. But the significant amount of money, what the Democrats really are hoping for is some kind of a big anti-Trump wave in Oakland County that could both hinder and hurt Mike Bishop, who's from Rochester, and also could take out the sitting longtime Oakland County executive, L. Brooks Patterson. And then they basically just need a big turnout in Ingham County where there's a big, strong Democratic base, and they need to be competitive in Livingston.
Patterson up against Vicki Barnett, a rather impressive former state legislator on the Democratic side. We'll point out that the two polls released this month covering the 8th district both showed a Mike Bishop leading. The more recent one from the National Republican Congressional Committee, 18 percentage point lead. But even the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC poll from the first half of the month, showed Bishop with a 7-point lead. I think Epic MRA in Lansing most recently gave Hillary Clinton about a 6 or 7 point edge here in Michigan, for what that's worth. We'll also point out, Chad, that your paper, the Detroit News, reported on Friday that the nonpartisan Cook Political Report revised its rating for the 8th from likely Republican to leans Republican. What do you take from a revision like that?
Well, these handicap services look at these polls and look at these races, and when they see change late, I mean, Mike Bishop is not running like he has an 18-point lead. I mean, he is running like he's got a 4-point lead or something in that range, and so I mean, he's out, you know, with a lot of positive campaigns, TV ads for himself. And then this campaign is doing some attacks and trying to, label Susanna Shkreli like an Obama Clinton Democrat, and so they're trotting out those labels to try to tie her to the president and the candidate for president.
Any other thoughts here, Susan?
Well, we made the same call actually earlier for Inside Michigan Politics to move that race from likely to lean based on the activity that we're seeing. But, you know, lean Republican still means that Bishop is favored.
A less immediate question here. If Mike Bishop prevails in the eighth, do you feel we'll hear more from Susanna Shkreli, Susan?
Yes. She almost ran for state house earlier this year. She's only 29 years old. She has potentially a bright future ahead of her. But, you know, she is from an area in northern Oakland County that is not necessarily real favorable to Democrats.
I'd be curious what you think of the Patterson-Vicky Barnett contest here.
Well, this is a two-year seat. Now, the legislature a year or two ago went back and changed the election of this seat so they would change the timing of it.
I didn't think that actually made it to the governor.
Oh, well, I forgot
but
the battle
here. That could be
here.
A preview of lame duck.
Yeah, it may be so. but they basically, you know, Patterson is 77 years old. This you know, most people think this is his last term. He's been in office since 92. In this office before that, he was prosecutor for many years in Oakland County. I mean, he has built a regime there, and she is trying to topple it by basically saying it's time for some new blood and a time for a new plan and for Oakland County going forward.
Well, Brooks had a debilitating car accident several years ago,
right.
And you know, obviously that's left an impression on voters, for good or for ill. You know, he has a team that he really relies on. Bob Datto is known as one of the sharpest financial minds in the entire state. What Vicky Barnett has going for her is that Oakland County has changed quite a bit. Democrats do well in presidential years, and they've really tied Brooks to Trump in terms of some of the outrage comments that Patterson has made about Syrian immigrants. So if there's a year that it flips, it would probably be this one.
Is Patterson a Trump supporter?
Yes.
Okay. He is backing
the nominee.
And
just to note, the Democrats have won Oakland County for the past five election cycles. So they have the advantage there.
Presidential
election cycles. So this is where they think that the tide is now maybe close to changing. And we'll see. This is going to be a closely watched one on election night.
Chad Livengood, State Capitol reporter for the Detroit News, and Susan Demas, publisher and editor of Inside Michigan Politics. In the seventh, it's incumbent Republican Tim Walberg against Democratic challenger Gretchen Driscoll. More of the time, the seventh elects Republicans. Share your thoughts about this contest a week out, Susan.
We've just seen an enormous amount of spending. You can't really flip on the TV without seeing an ad from either Driscoll or Walberg. And I would say that Walberg still has the edge here. He's no stranger to close elections, and he's a fighter. But Gretchen Driscoll is giving him a run for his money. What she is fighting against right now is that liberal label that Walberg lays on all of his opponents, and it's a potent message down in that district.
You know, Donald Trump's reasonably popular, popular in the 7th district. There's another...
Some parts of the 7th district.
Okay, but that's an advantage for Walberg here.
This is a district that has changed in the last redistricting, so that it now includes Monroe County. Used to have Calhoun County, used to have a lot more Democrats and independents, and so they drew this district to be more advantageous and longevity for Congressman Walberg. Gretchen Driscoll comes from the eastern edge of the district in Saline. So, you know, arguably she's going to win Washtenaw County. She could win Monroe County. Branch, she's shaking her head and saying no, but...
No, Monroe, that's my opinion.
Branch and Hillsdale County are Walberg country. Most people think that Jackson County... Now, the one to watch for is Lenawee County. In 2008, in the Obama wave, Tim Walberg lost his home county to Mark Schauer. I was just talking to Mark Schauer about this Saturday night when he was speaking. Mark Schauer is the congressman who, for one term, and who then lost to Tim Walberg again in a rematch in 2010. So, you know, Lenawee County could be the key to Driscoll's fortunes in essentially, you know, winning well and picking and running up some numbers in Adrian and trying to flip this seat.
Where they also have a competitive state house race. as well, yeah, which could help Eaton County right here in Lansing. That's always a decisive one as well and should be helpful to Driscoll.
That's where I wanted to go next. There is one more Michigan congressional race I'd like to revisit, but let's save that for just a second here. I want to get your takes on the 71st House race between Republican incumbent Tom Barrett, Democratic challenger Teresa Abbott. This is a rematch between candidates whose contest 2 years ago was decided by 140-some votes. Does one of these candidates have a leg up, or is this one looks too close to call?
Yeah, it does. It's a 50-50 district. Democrats are counting on more Democratic voters coming to Abed's aid, which they did not in 2014, but it's a presidential year with higher turnout. Their problem is that Barrett is perhaps the strongest incumbent, one of the strongest candidates, period, that the Republicans have. He's a hard worker, he's a veteran, and he has kept this extremely close and actually favored to him. It's also a huge dollar race, perhaps one of the most expensive.
Democrats are hoping to narrow the Republican majority, and some are hoping to become the majority again. That would require flipping 9 districts from red to blue. A week out, Chad, how are the Democrats feeling?
Well, this is a pretty crucial one. I think there's some Democrats that I've talked to that having with this district in Eaton County that Teresa Abbott has not been, maybe having her in a rematch, she's not been the best candidate. Because she has a record, they've come out in the last week and taken some comments she said opposed to Common Core education standards on the stump somewhere. And then they show some video of her standing on the House floor talking about how she's voting in favor of a resolution related to Common Core. So they're hitting her pretty hard. And like in the TV wards here in the Lansing area, if you haven't seen a Driscoll Wahlberg ad, you've probably seen a Teresa Abbott or Tom Barrett ad. So this is going to be certainly one that's going to maybe come down to just a few hundred votes.
Let's touch briefly on what's going on up north. Jack Bergman, the Republican, against former Democratic Party Chairman Lon Johnson in the 1st District. 8 days out. Susan, where do you stand? What do you think?
So this is an open district, which obviously gives Democrats their best shot at taking a seat. It's held right now by a Republican, Dan Benashek, who's stepping down. This is really tough country for Democrats because it's shifting for the red. Trump is popular up there, but Lon Johnson has raised just a ton of money. He's stressing his Second Amendment credentials. Both sides are playing very heavily, both parties, and this one looks like it's coming down to the wire.
Any thoughts on the first, Chad?
It was interesting. Lon Johnson started this campaign really focused on the pipeline running underneath the Straits of Mackinac, and that hasn't really been like an issue of this campaign. It's all been about who's the carpetbagger here, or more of one. Lon Johnson just moved, has had a cabin there and has family ties in Kalkaska and kind of moved back there a few years ago. And Jack Bergman lives in the Waters Meet, which if you don't know where that is, just Google it. It's on the western edge of the upper peninsula, and he has basically also maintained a second home in Louisiana, and so they've been fighting over basically. And Lon Johnson has an apartment, or his wife does at least, in Detroit. So they've both been back and forth fighting about who's really the native here. Interesting side point here is this has long been, almost for over 100 years, a seat that's been held by someone who resides in the upper peninsula. Yeah. So for Lon Johnson from Kalkaska to try to make a stab at this, this is going to be a potential change in who represents the North.
We've just got a minute. I'd like to know what your plans are for the next 8 days, where your travels will take you, and where you'll be on election night.
I'm not planning to get much sleep. I'll probably be across the state in various places, probably in Detroit on election day.
I'm going to Warren today for Donald Trump's rally. I was in Warren last night. And then I don't know where I'm going to be the next 3 or 4 days. It just kind of depends on where the winds blow in this state. And I'll probably be in Detroit at the news' home office on election night.
There's no Republican gathering to attend this year,
there will
correct?
Be Trump
Well,
parties,
the Trump campaign says they're going to do something or multiple parties. But yeah, the Republican Party of Michigan is not holding an election night party. They decided that these parties can cost like $30,000, $40,000. And they decided that they needed to put the money into races, which just shows you that they are definitely spending pulling all the stops right now to maintain majorities in the state house and the Supreme Court and try to get as close as possible on Hillary Clinton on election night.
Excellent discussion. I want to thank both of our guests, Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, Chad Live, the both sleep deprived but still alert and plugged in and turned on, Chad Live and Good, state capitol reporter for the Detroit News. Thanks much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, we'll talk with MLive reporter Garrett Ellison about an effort to create what would be Michigan's largest Indian reservation. That's in the Petoskey area. A lawsuit filed by the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians seeks that designation for hundreds of square miles around Petoskey. That's later on Current State. Well, it's that time of year again, time for the beloved East Lansing Film Festival. Every year, the film festival takes on a certain flavor created by the particular films that are presented, and this year that flavor is exceptional people. This year's films feature a diverse range of people and subjects, eloquent journalists who happen to write obituaries, a horse and his owner that defied all odds, and artists who create from yarn, kicking off this Thursday at Studio C in Okemos. The festival goes a full week and ends Thursday, November 10th. Joining us by phone today, Festival Director Susan Wood. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Opening night is Thursday. You have a screening of a documentary film about a guy many in Michigan regard, many in our state regard as a hero, but maybe some others outside the state may not know about. Tell our listeners who that is.
It's a wonderful documentary called Walk With Me, The Trials of Damon J. Keith. And this is the federal judge, Judge Keith, who started out as a Detroit janitor and became a judge and had four major decisions on civil rights in housing, jobs, education, and law enforcement. He is a groundbreaking, incredible human being. He's 94 years old. He's still alive. And this documentary was brought to light, or the subject matter was brought to light by Mitch Albom, who produced the film.
Let's hear a clip from the movie.
The federal government said, we can listen in on people's conversations. And Judge Keith at the court said, no, you can't.
One little black district court judge in the early 70s standing up to the federal government.
I would imagine that there were advisors to the judge would be saying, play safe. Judge Keith has never played it safe.
Are you expecting some important guests for this?
Yes, we're hoping that Judge Keith will make it. The director will be there. The producer will be there, Sally Davis. And also Frank Kelly has said that he would be coming.
Wow. Well, documentaries make up a huge part of the ELFF. I understand your favorite one, which was screened at the Traverse City Film Festival, is called Obit. What's it about?
Well, I love the New York Times obituaries. Always have. Almost read them, you know, first before I start ingesting all the news. And here we have a wonderful documentary all about it with probably the most eloquent people talking about what it takes to write an obituary. So it's we're very lucky we're going to be having the director coming. Her name is Vanessa Gould, and it should just be a wonderful evening.
Let's hear a clip.
It's counterintuitive, ironic even, but obits have next to nothing to do with death, and in fact, absolutely everything to do with the life.
I understand your fascination with obituaries. A well-crafted, well-written obituary is almost, it's like a short story or a novel compressed into a hundred or so words. Why did you like it so much?
Well, I mean, because it has always fascinated me, the obituaries, how they take, you know, you learn the life of a story. You learn, you know, the man who invented the Slinky versus the man who, you know, was president of the United States. And so you learn about all these different individuals who have lived a life and you can learn about it.
If it's well written, you can learn a lot in a few words.
Exactly. It's just a wonderful documentary.
Another documentary in the festival, An Act of Love. This one looks pretty powerful. Tell us about it.
Yes, this is about a minister of the United Methodist Church whose son came out as being gay, and then he performed the same-sex marriage for him. And the church found out about it and tried to defrock him. And we are there as this whole process is unfolding, and he's just a very devout, wonderful man who had conflicts with this issue because, you know, homosexuality is against the church, but then, you know, we see it slowly change in how it's resolved.
It sounds extremely compelling. We have a clip from the trailer. We'll hear the voices of what sounds like the son and then his father.
I knew that the Methodist Church wouldn't allow it, and I knew if I asked him, he would do it.
I had to help my son. He was hurt by the doctrine of the church. It was an act of love.
And there you have the title, An Act of Love. Another documentary that earned a lot of recognition, Harry and Snowman. This is about Harry DeLayer and his horse. What's going on here?
Well, Harry DeLayer was sort of convinced by his daughter to go to a horse auction in Ohio, and he saw this white horse, and something just clicked, and so he bought him for $90, and then the horse went on to win every possible award in dressage and in jumping, and you see the relationship between this horse and this man. It is just... Well, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just a beautiful story and beautifully told.
Here's a clip from Harry and Snowman.
I came to this country with nothing in my pocket. Snowman and me, we made it to the top of the world.
Harry DeLayer and Snowman have done it. They have won the 1958 Triple Crown.
Harry and Snowman, the name of that. I'm speaking with Susan Woods, director of the East Lansing Film Festival, which runs November 3rd through 10th at Studio C, the Hanna Community Center, and Wells Hall at Michigan State University. Let's talk about the documentary called The Last Laugh. It appears to do a very tricky thing, which is explore whether the Holocaust is something that can be joked about. How does it do that, Susan?
Well, I mean, it is obviously a very sensitive subject, but what this film does is it deconstructs what comedy is all about, and we listen to the best of the best from Mel Brooks to Rob Reiner to Sarah Silverman, you know, talking about what comedy is, what is funny, and what you can make fun of and what you can't. And it tackles both issues. It tackles, you know, but it also talks about this woman who was in the camps and how she made light of it. And she found a little light in the darkness. So it is just a very sort of a complex, wonderful film that also makes you laugh.
We can get an idea of the tone of this documentary from the trailer. This is one joke told back and forth by Gilbert Gottfried and Rob Reiner.
Two Jews have been sent to assassinate Hitler.
This is during the war. They've gotten some intelligence as to where Hitler might be.
They're standing outside his home.
They're hiding. They're waiting for Hitler. 8 o'clock comes. go. No Hitler.
An hour goes by. He's not home yet.
Where's Hitler?
Then another 2 hours go by. He's not home yet.
Now it's 8:30. He still doesn't show up. And one Jew turns to the other and says,
gee, I hope nothing happened to him.
Oh, my gosh. That's good. What I find interesting about this, Susan, we've just got a few seconds, is this whole idea of what used to be acceptable as joke fodder a lot of times is not acceptable anymore. Does this movie get at that?
Yes, it does. It talks about that. But, you know, there are other issues. I mean, there's the Holocaust, there's 9/11, you know, there's AIDS. I mean, what can you really make fun of? I mean, these are tragedies, human tragedies, that we should not make light of. So that's sort of what it tackles. So and you learn a lot, and it's a great film.
I see you were putting out a call for volunteers. Do you still need volunteers at this time?
Yes, please.
Okay.
All they need to do is go to elff.com and click on volunteers and sign up. And, you know, the film festival is going to run for 8 days. Opening night is going to be spectacular. And we have, you know, films for everybody. So I hope they will come out. And then on Wednesday at Hannah, we will have a surprise film, Susan's Surprise. So keep your eyes and ears open for that.
Okay. ELFF.com is where you find all the information. Susan Woods on this year's East Lansing Film Festival. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
And on the way on Current State, despite the MSU football losing streak moving to 6 straight, the latest coming at the hands of in-state rival Michigan, the Spartans are staying optimistic. We'll talk about it with Current sports host Al Martin on the way. A quick reminder that WKAR's Current State team, in conjunction with the MSU Department of Journalism and our communication arts colleagues here at Michigan State, will be coming to you live on election night here on WKAR. I'll be popping in 2 or 3 times an hour here with the latest results and interviews and reports from around mid-Michigan. Lots to keep track of. We'll be here live a week from tomorrow night, starting at 7 o'clock here on WKAR. One of Michigan's most popular tourist areas is the subject of a lawsuit that could turn hundreds of square miles into an Indian reservation. The area includes several cities, including Petoskey and Harbor Springs. The federal district court suit is expected to take years to play out in court, especially as the losers appeal to higher courts. To learn more about this suit and what could happen as a result, I spoke with reporter Garrett Ellison. He's covering the story for MLive.
Well, the Little Traverse Bay Band wants the state to recognize what they say was a reservation created by treaties that the federal government signed with predecessor tribes in 1836 and 1855. And what it is it's 337 square miles of land in Emmett County and Charlevoix County. It's most of Emmett County and a lot of the northern part of Charlevoix County, plus a couple islands in the Beaver Island chain.
The tribe's attorney, Jim Bransky, says this is not about getting land back. What is it about? What's motivating the tribe here? Do you know?
Well, it's not entirely clear what's motivating the tribe, other than a sort of a desire to reassert their jurisdiction over ancestral homeland. It's what they're saying. They're saying they're not seeking title to private land. So if you're a private property owner up there and you're not a member of the tribe, he's saying we're not coming after your property. But what the tribe wants to do is make this wide swath of northern, the tip of the Mitt, an Indian reservation, which in effect, makes it a kind of sovereign nation under the jurisdiction of the tribe. In Michigan, it would be the largest Indian reservation like that in the state. And it would create quite a jurisdictional confusion, at least initially, if the reservation was created.
Is that the primary impact here? I mean, they're seeking tribal jurisdiction of this area. What exactly does that mean?
Well, tribes exercise a kind of sovereignty over their land. They're really not bound to local and state law. Most federal law is what they're bound to. So, you know, they wouldn't, if you're a tribal member, they would sort of control issues of land use, zoning, construction permitting, environmental protection, taxation, business fees, that sort of thing. A lot of this is sort of, it's hard to say what the impacts are. But the lawyers that are opposing this are saying the tribe could impose additional taxes and fees, approve policies that would allow the proliferation of slot machines through the area. Could allow, there's tribes out west that are using their sovereignty to grow marijuana. You know, there's some question as to if you were a non-tribal member engaged in a contractual business relationship of some sort with an Indian who was a part of the tribe, and that went to court, it would automatically go to tribal court, and that's has very different civil procedure, appellate process, different transparency levels. There's a, potentially some criminal matters that would, could you could end up in tribal court. And it'll be opposing parties, the defendants in this case, are arguing that this sort of jurisdictional uncertainty will discourage investment in the area, and that people who want to open a business but don't have that sort of guaranteed lock of zoning and building codes and that's been developed through state and local law over the last 160 years, they'll go elsewhere. They'll open their business in the southern part of Charlevoix, or they'll go on to Walden Lake, or they'll just avoid the area in general.
We'll point out that at 337 square miles, it would become, as you've said, the largest reservation in Michigan, currently the 328 square miles of the Lac Vieux d'Isere Reservation in Gogebic County on the Michigan-Wisconsin border is the largest. What can you tell us about how Judge Paul Maloney is handling this case?
This summer, he bifurcated the case, and essentially he split it in half, and the first half of the case, well, the expert witness reports, essentially the historians for either side, next summer, their reports are due. And the first half of the case is tackling the question of whether or not these treaties in the 1800s did in fact create a reservation, as the tribe is claiming. And so there will be a lot of historical interpretation as to what the Indians at the time thought that they were getting from the U.S. government.
Hmm.
That's essentially the way that this will be, the lens that this will be viewed from. If Judge Maloney decides that there was a reservation created, the second half of the case then gets into the untangling this new layer of jurisdiction and how whether or not the tribe will adopt local zoning or decide that it's not interested in adopting local zoning. I think that's one of the big concerns. You know, Harbor Springs is within this disputed reservation boundary, and it's sort of known for being this quaint small town that's kept McDonald's out of, you know, the quaint downtown area.
Okay.
And they're saying that, okay, well, if the tribe is in control of the land use governance, they could... any tribal member could buy a piece of property downtown and sell it to McDonald's and put up a McDonald's. And all this time we've spent trying to keep these chain restaurants out of our little tourist downtown would just solve for naught.
We're discussing a lawsuit filed by the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians seeking to have 337 square miles of land in the northern lower peninsula of Michigan declared an Indian reservation. Local governments and property owners in and near Petoskey worry that it could have a big impact on how the area is governed and what might happen to property values. Our guest is MLive reporter Garrett Ellison. What are local governments in the area saying, Garrett?
Well, the attorney for the city of Petoskey, Jim Murray, he's essentially saying we don't really know what the impacts are right now at this stage. He said it could impact taxes, law enforcement, environmental issues, building codes, liquor licenses, things of that nature. He's saying the tribe, they didn't limit the scope of potential impact in their lawsuit. So it's not entirely clear exactly what they're going after, other than they want jurisdiction over this area. Their criticism is that the claims in dispute are general in nature, that the tribe says the state is violating the Indian Child Welfare Act by exercising authority over child custody issues in this area and not exempting tribal members from state income tax in this area, but it's not citing any specific instances of that. So the local attorneys are saying, well, you know, we think there's more here that's not being disclosed. We think there's more behind this that the tribe isn't saying.
What are property owners saying about this?
They're not happy about this. They are concerned. They're concerned that it could impact property values, impact investment in the area. The reservation, the claimed reservation boundary, includes 103 miles of Michigan shoreline, essentially the entire Lake Michigan coast of Emmett County. So the people who own property in that area are not likely to be happy that there's another layer of jurisdiction that they would have to deal with in order to do things with their property. Now, the tribe is essentially saying, you know, that these jurisdictional confusions could all be worked out through intergovernmental agreements, cooperation agreements of the sort that were figured out in the Saginaw Chippewa case a few years ago that created an Indian reservation in the Mount Pleasant area. And there was more than a dozen intergovernmental agreements that spelled out how law enforcement and child custody and taxation, nuisance law, and other jurisdictional issues are handled in Isabella County.
Has Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette weighed in?
His office has answered the lawsuit. They dispute that there was a reservation created, but they're not commenting on the story.
MLive reporter Garrett Ellison is covering the story of a lawsuit filed by the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians seeking to have 337 square miles of land in the northern lower peninsula of Michigan declared an Indian reservation. Thank you, Garrett.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Well, for the first time since 2012, the Paul Bunyan Trophy will get cozy in Ann Arbor. Michigan State football coming up short at Spartan Stadium against Michigan, 32-23 on Saturday. Two teams trending in opposite directions. Current sports host Al Martin joins us now with more. Hi, Al.
Mark, how you doing?
23-point Vegas spread. MSU lost by 9, and the last play of the game was as ugly as it can get. But in the end, did you think this game was going to be as close as it turned out?
No, not at all. I mean, as you just mentioned, I mean, the line actually went up by the end of the week to 24.5 points in favor of U of M. And I predicted a 21-14 U of M win, but I didn't believe that, Mark. I mean, this is a team that coming in and still is the number two college football team in the nation. Michigan State loses a 5 straight approach in this game, not even ranked in the Associated Press top 25 poll. I mean, nobody thought this game was going to be close. But you look at that, how that game went, Mark. The first drive, Michigan State goes 12 plays, over 70 yards. They take off 7 minutes on the clock. They score first, go up 7-0, and you're sitting there thinking, okay, Michigan State came to play today. That was my immediate thought, you know?
It was everybody's.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the thing, though. When you look at rivalry games, and particularly this one, Michigan and Michigan State, no matter what the records are, no matter how the season has gone prior to, when those two teams get on the gridiron, it's one of those rivalries where records kind of go out the window, Mark.
What does the injury to Brian Lewerke now do for MSU moving forward, just four games left in the season?
Well, I think that when you evaluate Lewerke's play this past weekend, Mark, he was the better out of the two quarterbacks we saw between Tyler O'Connor and himself. I thought he had a great game. I think that when you talk about Lewerke, you know, he's the best downfield passer that Michigan State has. You look at the TD throw that he had to Monte Medeiros. I thought that was an unbelievable throw. I think maybe possibly the best throw of the year so far. He's a spark plug off the bench. I mean, you saw what he was able to do. He comes in the fourth quarter and he immediately leads Michigan State down the field for a touchdown. And, you know, Jabril Peppers, who was in the running for the Heisman Trophy this season, he sacks Brian Lewerke on that fourth down. He goes down. Lewerke breaks his tibia. Lewerke's stat line was pretty impressive. He completes over 50% of his passes, 6 of 10, 100 yards, a touchdown in the fourth quarter. Now I think it's solidified that Tyler O'Connor is going to be the starting quarterback for the final four games. Mm. A loss, though, a big loss. Mm.
The Detroit Lions' winning streak was halted at 3, losing to the Houston Texans on the road yesterday afternoon. What did the Texans do to slow down the previously hot Lions?
Well, when you look at the Lions in that game, Mark, I was particularly impressed with Theo Riddick. I mean, this is a guy who had a solid day after missing two games due to the ankle injury. He goes 11 carries, 56 yards, not to mention tight end Eric Ebron, 7 catches for 79 yards, but 8 penalties. And the Lions converted just 27% of their third downs. That's not winning football. And then the coaching mistakes. I mean, why not challenge the DeAndre Hopkins incompletion midway through the fourth? They gave up 3 points on that drive. That proved to be pivotal as the game went on. And why an onside kick with 2 minutes and 53 seconds left to play and down by a touchdown? Kick it deep, trust your defense, and give Matthew Stafford another chance to pull off a last-second miracle. Coaching blunders mixed with penalties, that's what really doomed the Lions in this game, Mark, in my estimation.
Speaking of questionable calls, let's back up just a little bit here. I should have asked you this before. I'll ask it now. What did Coach D'Antonio say about going for two at the tail end of the game on Saturday?
The gist that I got from that answer, Mark, because we were all puzzled when we saw Michigan State go for two when they didn't need to. But Mark D'Antonio justified it as this. He's trying to, quote unquote, find the inches. No matter what, you know, if they get a two-point conversion there, he's speaking more so on momentum. That would do a lot for the team, mental from a mental standpoint moving forward. But it still was very puzzling. It was more so from a psyche standpoint than a logical one, if you ask me, Mark. Still, just take the points. Take the extra point and let's keep it moving.
Back to the Lions. We hit the road next week to play a team featured on Monday Night Football tonight, the Vikings. Do you see quarterback Matthew Stafford having success against one of the best defenses in the league?
That's tough to say. That's a tall order, Mark. I mean, this is the best defense in the league, and which we'll get to see in action against the Chicago Bears on Monday Night Football tonight, Mark. But this is a defense that's allowed no more than, 16 points and has 9 interceptions on the season. They do have a bad run game, though. They're only averaging 2.6 yards per carry. And get this. This is the stat of the day for Lions fans out there. The Vikings are on pace for the lowest in the NFL, the lowest yards per carry in the NFL since the 1946 Lions did.
Ouch.
So back with 1.7 yards per carry.
How crazy is that? It had to be the Lions.
It had to be the Lions, right? Back in 1940. Yeah, how ironic is that, right? And the Lions play the Vikings this upcoming weekend.
It's worth noting that the MSU hockey team got its first win of the season Friday night at Mon over Princeton. What enabled the Spartans to finally get a W after starting out 0-4?
Yes, a balanced attack, Mark. 6 different Spartans scored, 4 goals in the second period alone. And I was particularly impressed with Ed Minnie, who had 21 saves on the night. So now, you know, this team finally gets a win after starting 0-4, as you just mentioned. They have a 2-game homestand versus Michigan Tech this weekend. Let's see if they can rebound off that.
And the Cubs are still alive in the World Series after going almost the whole game very tight last night. Harbaugh and his dad. Harbaugh showed up at the game with his ball glove. Wow, how perfect was that? Quickly, Al, which local teams are still left after the opening weekend of the high school football
playoffs?
Yeah,
we've got a few, Mark. DeWitt, Mason, Alma, Lakewood, Sexton, Corunna, the powerhouse that is Ithaca, Portland, and also PW, and a few more in that mix as well. But those were some of the big games from Friday night last week.
Everything but the Pro Bowlers Tour, a part of this segment here, Al. Well done.
We tried to cram it in, didn't we? Oh.
Al Martin, more today and every weekday at 1 o'clock. Current Sports with Al Martin on AM 870 WKAR. Thanks, Al.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
That's our show for today. Tuesday on Current State, writer and Michigan native Christine Lasik moved to Florida a few years ago, but home still influenced her work.
You know, suddenly I'm in Tampa, Florida, and it's hot and wet all the time, and suddenly I'm writing about fall leaves and cool nights.
Scott Pohl talks with Christine Lasik about her collection of short stories called Love Letters to Michigan. Plus, the Broad Art Museum brings a forward-thinking exhibit to its halls this weekend. Learn from the Broad's Kathleen Doherty about how artists envision Ireland 100 years from now in 2116. This is the name of the exhibit, 2116, Forecast of the Next Century. That and more Tuesday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, Drew Hill, and Al Martin. The Current State Podcast, your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Connect with it at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a fun Halloween. I'm Mark Bayshore. We'll see you tomorrow on Current State.